Hi, I'm Phelan Johnson.
And I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and we look at history a bit differently. Have you ever wondered how hundreds of wild horses came to inhabit an island in the Atlantic Ocean?
Or what Lord of the Rings and a small town in Manitoba have in common? Or the burning question, did Canada invent the teen drama?
The Secret Life of Canada is a podcast about the country you know and the stories you don't. New episodes available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Welcome to Ideas. I'm Nala Ayed. You don't need me to tell you that these are anxious times. War, climate change, mass migration, geopolitical turmoil, biodiversity loss, economic insecurity, the lingering effects of one pandemic and the inevitability of another at some point, and, well, you get the picture. Very big, very human problems that require human solutions. And as if we didn't have enough problems to contend with, we went and invented another, artificial intelligence, a threat that seemed rather far off until the seismic shift brought by an AI chatbot called ChatGPT. It's been enough to make a renowned pioneer of AI, the University of Toronto's Geoffrey Hinton, resign from his position at Google so he could speak openly about his fears of the threat it could pose to humanity, as he did with the CBC's Adrian Arsenault.
I think there are things to be worried about. There's all the normal things that everybody knows about, but there's another threat that's rather different from those, which is if we produce things that are more intelligent than us, how do we know we can keep control?
And what tends to happen when...
Well, if we're talking about evolution, all these species are evolving, and what tends to happen is it doesn't go well for the less intelligent species.
The other one kills it?
Not necessarily. Ants look after aphids because they produce honey, but...
Ants are in charge.
Ants are in charge, yes.
Many of our most profound problems need more than human solutions. They need solutions from science, too. And that can make things even trickier because our society's relationship with science is complicated. Our lives may be thoroughly infused with and embedded in science and technology, but misinformation and distrust of science run rampant, much of it stoked, ironically, by what we do with our pocket-sized packets of supercharged science called smartphones.
My name is Martin Rees, and I've spent much of my life as a university professor, mainly in Cambridge, studying astronomy and physics and space science.
Martin Rees is, in fact, one of the world's most eminent astronomers. He serves as Astronomer Royal in the UK, along with being a member of the House of Lords. He argues that our future rests on humanity and science working together in a mutual understanding.
Indeed, the crises confronting the world can't be tackled without more and better directed science. So, if we're scientists seeking to understand the world as well as change it, what are our responsibilities? How can our efforts be optimized? How should we engage with the public and with government? How should we teach and inspire the next generation?
Martin Rees's latest book is called If Science is to Save Us. I began our conversation by asking about times when science has saved us in the past.
Well, of course, the most obvious thing I'd say is that the population of the world has doubled in the last 50 years. And around 1970, there were books written by the Club of Rome and by Paul Ehrlich, who claimed that there would be mass starvation in the 70s and 80s. But of course, the Green Revolution did enable more food to be grown. And it's true that there is starvation in many parts of the world now, but it's due to maldistribution or wars, not to overall food shortage. So that's the most obvious case where if we hadn't had modern science, the world population would not have been able to grow to as much as 8 billion.
Mm-hmm. So that was the science that did the saving. But what is it about that particular situation or that particular knowledge that made it possible?
to save us?
Well, I think we've got to bear in mind that science is a way of understanding the world, and understanding the world is a precondition for being able to change the world. But the main theme of my book is that the changes which science enables us to do can be beneficial, but can also be disastrous. And the main thing is to choose among the various things that science can do and ensure we can secure the benefits. And we know with all the benefits of technology which stem from science that there are severe downsides, and we've got to minimize those. But I think if we look at the modern world, then we know how it depends, obviously, on 19th century discoveries like electricity and also on 20th century discoveries. And some of those, nuclear, for instance, have been potentially disastrous as well. And, of course, telecommunications, which has changed the world completely, especially now, and computers. These are adaptations of technology in a very sophisticated way, which empower us in all kinds of ways. And, of course, the other thing that's happened is that medicine has not cured all diseases, of course, but it's allowed average life expectancy to increase. It's greatly decreased infant mortality, etc. And on the whole, I think we would say that science has benefited us in a way that indicates that we've made use of the good things it can do and avoided the most disastrous things it could have done.
And of course, there's no greater example of the medical intervention in improving our lives than the most recent one, which is, you know, the formulation of vaccines with the pandemic.
Well, that's right, although some people would say that the propensity to mass pandemics is a consequence of the fact that we can travel more and pandemics can spread from one continent to another due to aircraft. So the fact that a pandemic can spread globally is, of course, a downside of the development of technology, which allows us to move around the world. But, of course, as you say, the achievement of vaccines within a year was a great achievement, especially if you realize that we don't have a vaccine for HIV even after 40 years.
Mm-hmm. I think in many ways, the irony or the instability of holding those two thoughts in our mind of science being both beneficial and negative is one of the biggest problems of our time.
Yes, but it's not surprising, is it really? Because science is ethically neutral as such, mm-hmm. and the way we apply it depends on social organization, economic organization, and obviously science has enabled weaponry of war to get more catastrophic, but also it's provided all these benefits.
Mm-hmm. I guess in terms of thinking about what the compact is between society and scientists, is it your belief that science is still in a position to save us?
Yes, I think so. But of course, you talk about the compact. I mean, I think a manifestation of that is that governments feel it's worthwhile to support lots of science education in universities, to support research institutes, to develop new technology, etc. And I think we are in a world where the dangers are growing. They're growing because we have a larger population, a population which is more demanding of energy resources, and we do have to ensure that everyone can be fed. We want to extend life expectancy if we can, at least minimize premature deaths. And of course, high on the agenda now is coping with climate change. And that certainly needs development of a new clean technology. And many of the basic ideas that are needed for that already exist, but actually turning them into some economical way of generating energy, not just in the developed countries of the North, but in the global South, is a huge challenge to technology and politics.
How much do you think does science need to save us from ourselves?
Well, I mean, I think in the ways I've been discussing that if it's applied beneficially, it can help. But of course, all the weapons which have been devised are, in a sense, developed from scientific ideas, supremely the nuclear bomb. Mm-hmm. And so obviously they can be used dangerously. And if we look at what's happened in the 21st century, I worry very much about the misuse of biotech, because the same kind of knowledge which allowed us to identify the virus of COVID-19 and to produce a vaccine against it would allow scientists of evil intent to develop a virus, more virulent and more transmissible than natural ones. We're kidding ourselves if we think that those with technical expertise will all be balanced and rational. Expertise can be allied with fanaticism, not just the kind of fundamentalism with which we're currently familiar, but that's exemplified by some New Age or conspiracy theorists and the like. And there'll be individuals with the mindset of those who now unleash computer viruses, the mindset of arsonists. The global village will have its village idiots. In a future era of vast individual empowerment, when even one malign or foolish act could be one too many, how can our open society be safeguarded? The raising empowerment of tech-savvy groups, or even individuals, by biotech and by cybertech as well, will pose an intractable challenge to governments and aggravate the tension between three values we cherish. That's freedom, privacy, and security. The world was underprepared for COVID-19. More broadly, it's unprepared for the intellectual, moral, and practical challenges that are posed by burgeoning biotechnology. These challenges call for clear thinking and well-crafted policies which recognise both its stupendous potential boon to human flourishing, but also its stupendous potential risk to human safety, indeed to humanity itself. It's an arena where the regulations that ethics and prudence require may not only prove controversial, but nearly impossible to enforce. And that's scary. And I think we're going to have to give up privacy, because we can't take the risk of even a single person trying to develop some very dangerous pathogen.
I'd like to talk about what you call these global mega challenges in your book. And the first one, as you mentioned, is biodiversity loss and connected with that, how to feed an ever-growing global population. When you look at the scope of the problems that have plagued humanity in recent centuries, where would you place that as a threat?
Well, of course, there have always been famines. There have always been pandemics. But now that the world is more crowded, for the first time, we are empowered and numerous enough to have a effect on the entire planet. Until 100 or 200 years ago, the population of the world wasn't really affecting the natural world overall very much. Whereas, as we now know, we are encroaching on the natural habitats around the world, forests, etc., and reducing the diversity of species which can exist. And also, we are taking so much energy from fossil fuels that we are changing the Earth's climate.
Mm-hmm. How close do you think science is to solving some of the fundamental problems posed by this, you know, in the effort to find a greater solution that could actually mitigate the problem of possibly us, you know, having too many people and not enough resources?
Well, on the population issue, which is important, the population has been growing fast over most parts of the world. It's now leveled off in most countries in the global north. Mm-hmm. The only places where population growth is fast, in the sense that the birth rate is much higher than the replacement level, are sub-Saharan Africa and parts of India. And the trends during the rest of this century in those parts of the world are going to be crucial for the balance between different regions, because if the population in Africa doubles, and if that's combined with changes in climate, which makes some parts of the world uninhabitable, this is going to cause mass migration and huge changes in entire global politics.
Yes, but what hints do you have currently that we have the science or will have the science to tackle these issues in terms of dealing with, you know, how to feed an ever-growing population?
Well, we do have the science. It's really we need to have the economics as well. We know that we can have intensive agriculture, which will allow more food to be grown without encroaching on natural forests. We know also that we can even make artificial meat now. which is an ethical advantage and also greater efficiency. So we know that we can do these things, just as we know we can vaccinate everyone in the world against lots of diseases. And what is inhibiting the rapid deployment of these advances is politics and economics.
So to take the one example that you provided, you know, that there's the prospect of artificially grown meat.
Yes.
Cultured from a few cells in a lab. And there is kind of a high ick factor for a lot of people. How do you respond to the opposition to those kinds of things or the distaste for those kinds of things?
You're quite right about that, because people may not take it on. It could be that it's expensive to make and it's only used as pet food. That won't be a huge advantage. But I think everyone accepts that eating beef is something which many of us enjoy. But it would not be possible for the 9 billion people who'll be on the planet by mid-century to eat beef at the rate that the average American does today, without using up too much land and producing too much CO2 and all the rest of it. So there's got to be some changes in diet and, of course, an increase in food production if those who are now undernourished are to be fed properly.
So what is the persuasive argument to the people who argue that you can't depend on technology when it's unproven or hasn't been developed, and that what we really have to do is change the economy and our way of life?
Well, I think we're seeing this in the case of climate change, which, of course, is a serious political issue. And the challenge is to get governments to accept that we've got to be far-sighted enough to care about the lives of our grandchildren, and to make perhaps some sacrifices now in terms of our choice of how we spend government money and invest, in order to ensure that we don't leave a depleted world for our descendants. So it's really an issue of politics and ethics, ensuring that government funds are spent on the kind of things which will be beneficial to future generations. Most of us are aware of the heritage we've been left by past generations. And we'd be depressed, I think, if we thought there'd be not many generations to come. We should be good ancestors, and we have a moral imperative not to leave a depleted inheritance for our successors.
What about the opposition to things like, you know, GMO in food production or nuclear power to address climate change?
Yes. Well, GMO, I think, is interesting, because I think most people would say that the opposition is for GMO in plants is pretty irrational. And in fact, the European Union has banned it completely. And I think that that's clearly over the top, because in the US, nearly 300 million people have lived for 30 years doing a vast control experiment on the use of those GM crops with no manifest detriment. And so that's an example where I think the hostility is irrational. I mean, it's based on a sort of precautionary principle that if something could conceivably go wrong, then we shouldn't do the technology at all. So we've got to have a balance and accept some slight risk, but not too many. And I think in the case of GM, then I think the balance in Europe has shifted too far against them. Nuclear is interesting, because the case of nuclear energy and nuclear power, this is an issue which divides people at all levels of expertise. The general public has diverse views, but among experts, similarly, there are diverse views. As I know from the time when I was president of the Royal Society, the British Academy, we didn't have a party line on whether we should be pro-nuclear power stations or against them, because even the experts were divided. And so that's an example of a technology where it's going to be very hard to get agreement, because, as you know, in different countries, the policy changes. The Germans have just decided a few years ago to abandon their nuclear power, etc. And so that's an example of a political decision, which is a very difficult one. And scientists who try to advise governments, they have a very difficult choice, because they have to make the point that it's a balance of probabilities, and we have to make judgments without knowing what's correct. And that was true, of course, of the medics at the beginning of the pandemic. They didn't quite know what was going to happen. They didn't know how quickly they would develop a vaccine, but they had to give the best advice they could at the time. So When there's something urgent, then you have to take a decision. But when things are very long term, how are we going to get power in the second half of the century, then, of course, we do have to take account, you know, can we improve nuclear power to make it safer and cheaper or not?
Whose job is it, do you think, to dispel the misconceptions about technologies like GMO?
Well, I think that that's an educational issue and going down to the schools. I think people need to understand what's involved and why most experts are relaxed about GM crops. But of course, why at the same time they're not at all relaxed about the idea of using gene editing on humans. So we've got to understand a bit of the technology in order to understand what regulations they should support. But the other problem which arises, particularly in the case of climate, is that we have to think ahead a long time, because, of course, to build new power stations of any kind is a big construction project. And if you want to bring down the cost of solar or wind energy so that it can be afforded by developing countries, so that they can leapfrog directly to clean energy, just as they've leapfrogged directly to smartphones and never had landlines, that's something which requires a rebalancing of our technological effort. And one point which applies especially to these long-term concerns about climate change, they tend to slip down the agenda of politicians, because politicians have urgent issues and they care about what's going to happen in the next election, but they don't necessarily prioritise something which is going to have an effect 20 or 30 or 50 years ahead. That's the problem. And they will only take action which benefits people in the long term if they think voters will support it. And so I think it's very important that scientists should try to ensure that the public understands the long-term threats and the ways we can avoid or at least mitigate them. And most scientists aren't very charismatic, and when they try to be political advisors, they perhaps don't get enough political attention if the politicians have urgent things to worry about. And that's why we depend on having some charismatic influences. And I mention in my book a rather sort of disparate quartet of people who collectively have had quite a big influence on making the public take climate change more seriously. These four are Pope Francis, who, through his encyclical, made people care about the whole of creation, not just humanity, and also influenced the conference in Paris in 2015. Our secular Pope, David Attenborough, is another one, because his TV programmes have certainly alerted a very wide public to the reality of climate change and also to loss of biodiversity and other degradation of the environment, like ocean pollution. And the third one is Bill Gates, who is a respected technical figure who has written very sensibly and seriously about what is feasible. And in particular, incidentally, he's talked about how we can make a better fourth generation of nuclear power stations, which are safer than the present ones. And the fourth is Greta Thunberg, who, of course, has influenced the younger generation. And I think because of those four people, the priority of dealing with climate change on the political agenda has risen. And even the rhetoric of business has changed, though business perhaps isn't doing enough yet. But those influences have indirectly affected government, because the government does care what the average voter thinks. The UK's initially rather confused response to COVID-19 demonstrated how ill-prepared our country was to cope with emergencies. Pandemics are unpredictable, but not hugely improbable. Moreover, we need to be mindful of a range of other catastrophes, some global, others regional or local, like cyber attacks, grid breakdowns, radiation releases, failures of old infrastructure, or floods. They're rare enough to be easily ignored, even though the worst of them could be so devastating that one occurrence is one too many. It's a wise mantra that the unfamiliar is not the same as the improbable. On the national level, we need to rebalance the trade-off between resilience and efficiency. For instance, If manufacturers depend on supply chains spanning the world and on just-in-time delivery, they're vulnerable to a break of one link in one chain. We should shift from just-in-time to just-in-case. It may be efficient to routinely have high occupancy of intensive care beds in hospital, but it is imprudent as it leaves too little spare capacity for emergencies.
Martin Rees is an emeritus professor of cosmology and astrophysics at the University of Cambridge. His latest book is If Science Is to Save Us. You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, across North America on Sirius XM, in Australia on ABC Radio National, and around the world at cbc.ca/ideas. Ideas is a broadcast and a podcast. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find hundreds of past episodes of Ideas on the CBC Listen app and on our website. I'm Nala Ayed.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
In his distinguished academic career spanning more than five decades, Martin Rees has seen science create and solve problems on a grand scale. But even he is daunted by the scale and scope of the problems we face today. Some, like climate change or biodiversity loss, are caused by the demands humanity is placing on the Earth. Others, like the prospect of out-of-control artificial intelligence or rogue biotechnology, we can blame on our own cleverness with science itself. If science is to save us, governments and the public need to understand science so they can make informed decisions about what it can and can't and should and shouldn't do. But even though we live our lives today in such an intimate embrace with science, Rees is dismayed by how little most politicians and members of the public pay attention to science. And he thinks that when scientists do command the headlines, such as when the Nobel Prizes are awarded, it creates a distorted picture of how science works.
Nobel Prizes are given in certain areas of science, and they're given to never more than three people. And sometimes it is unfair if something is collaborative or if several individuals independently came up with more or less the same work at the same time. And it's also misleading because the public thinks that the winners of Nobel Prizes are all great intellects. Some of them are, but some of them are just lucky, or some of them have been part of some long-term project which didn't require any intellect different from the average university professor. So it's misleading that the public gets the impression that there's a big gap between the few geniuses who get these prizes and all the rest. But I think it's important to realise that science is a collective endeavour, and the benefit one has is one's contributing to something which is durable.
Rees also believes some of the splashiest, most sensational science, such as space travel, is misdirected and a distraction from the urgent work scientists need to do to address the biggest problems here on planet Earth.
The practical case for sending people into space is getting weaker all the time. It's far more expensive, they've got to be supported in space, and humans have to be brought back. I've argued that the sending of humans into space should receive no taxpayers' funds. So I think space flight by humans should be left to the private sector, to Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and their ilk. There'd still be many volunteers, some perhaps even accepting one-way tickets. Musk himself says he wants to die on Mars, but not on impact. But, and here I disagree with Musk, don't ever expect mass emigration from Earth. it's a dangerous delusion to think that space offers an escape from the Earth's problems. Dealing with climate change on Earth is a challenge, but it's a doddle compared to terraforming Mars. There's no planet B for ordinary risk-averse people.
Here's the second part of my conversation with Martin Rees. You say that it's not just a moral obligation, but it's in the rich world's interest to make sure that developing countries don't suffer disproportionately from things like climate change or famines and disease.
Well, I think it's not just altruism, because if we think of the impoverished people in Africa, etc., they may not have toilets, etc., but the one thing they do now have is the internet. So they know what life is like for the rest of us. They know the injustice of their fate, and they're going to be embittered if their conditions remain far, far worse than those of the global north. And so I think to ensure that there's a reduction in the huge inequality between the rich countries and the poor countries, I think it's an ethical imperative, just as incidentally, I think we should reduce the inequalities within countries. But it's also, I think, essential if we want to have a peaceful world. We don't want billions of embittered and disaffected people in it. So I think that's going to motivate efforts to ensure that the global south catches up. And also, it's not bad economics either, because if we can, in conjunction with experts in those countries, develop more efficient or more economical clean energy or energy storage and all the things we need for a carbon zero economy, then, of course, the huge market is going to be in the global south, which is where the population is growing. There's no point in us in the north achieving global zero if at the same time the countries of the global south are developing economically, as you want them to do, but doing this by having more coal power stations. We'll have CO2 emissions in that case, which are at least as high in 2050 as they are now, but they were just becoming then from the countries of the global south and no longer dominated by the global north.
Mm-hmm. I found it interesting you talking about in your book the fact that to solve some of these problems, national governments had to give up some of their sovereignty.
Yes.
Can you speak to the apparatus available and what's missing on the international stage to tackle some of these problems and deal with them as kind of global scientific problems?
Well, of course, we do have a lot of international organizations, well, the UN and its agencies, clearly. To take two others, the World Health Organization, which I think perhaps needs to be empowered more so it can cope better with identifying pandemics early. But that's an obvious organization which has a transnational remit. And, of course, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which applies universal regulations which are normally enforced and which is able to inspect nuclear facilities. So we need to try and have similar international regulation for other transnational activities. Of course, the internet and all that is an example. But there the concern now is that it's dominated by a few companies which straddle the world.
Yes.
And certainly are not in a nation. And that means we can't tax them properly and we can't regulate them properly. And I think if we are going to have effective action on climate change, we need to have some organization which actually monitors whether countries are complying with the pledges they make. Because at the COP conferences on climate change, nations make pledges.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got to make sure that they actually meet those and enforce them. And that's going to need some kind of international body, just as health does, because these global problems don't respect national boundaries, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Just on changing gears a little bit. Of course, we've been hearing and reading about the potential dangers of artificial intelligence, especially with the emergence of AI chatbots like
yes.
ChatGPT. You've made it clear that it's not all downsides and threats with biotech and AI. There's a lot of promise to improve our lives as well. And you touched on this a little bit, but how do you balance the promise and the threats to put the brakes on the stuff that could be dangerous without stifling what is worthwhile research?
Well, the simple answer to that is only with great difficulty, because technologies are sort of, in the jargon, they're dual use. They can be used for benefits or they can cause great damage. And so this is a challenge for governments. And the things you need to make a cyber attack are just computers, which are widespread, and to make a dangerous biological pathogen, an engineered virus, would take the kind of labs that exist in many universities and industries. Even if we do have regulations on what shouldn't be done in those labs, enforcing those regulations is going to be very, very hard indeed. Well, think of the lack of success in enforcing globally the tax laws or the drug laws, for instance.
Yes.
And it'll be just as hard to ensure safety of work being done in biological labs around the world.
But again, where does that conversation, where should that conversation be had?
Well, I think obviously in the United Nations, but I think formulating the regulations is the kind of thing where scientists themselves can do a lot. I mean, international academies can get together. As I say, I was head of the British version of that, the Royal Society, and these academies do get together and they decide what are appropriate regulations for some of these dangerous technologies. But of course, they themselves don't have clout unless governments take their advice. But they can certainly help in formulating appropriate regulations and, of course, in alerting the public and alerting politicians to new dangers which emerge. But of course, this requires a competent and well-advised government and also an electorate, which is either prepared to trust the government or is itself sufficiently educated to appreciate the reasons why we do need to do certain things and to constrain certain kinds of activities and modify our energy production, things like that. So I think it needs all those things to happen in order to safely cope with these new technologies and use them beneficially.
A lot of people would say that governments should set policy on issues like public health and climate change and the environment and technology,
yes,
according to scientific evidence.
Yes.
Where do you come down on this? Like, how big a role should scientists play in shaping policy?
Well, I mean, obviously, their input is essential in deciding what the consequences are of given action, whether this is releasing a pathogen or releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and all that. So the scientific advice is essential. But, of course, politicians have to take into account not just the science, but the economics and the social consequences. I mean, if we go back to the pandemic, the scientists, I think, acquitted themselves very well in giving advice to the government. But of course, the downside was the closure of schools and a loss of wealth, etc. And so there was a trade-off, and certainly in my country, and I think perhaps in yours as well,
yes,
there was a big question about how long one should have lockdowns and quarantine, because that may reduce the number of cases of COVID, but it may also do damage to the education of kids or their mental health if it closes a school. So those are the kind of things where the politicians need to listen to the scientists, but their job is very difficult because they've got to balance that against the other things. And a point which I think scientists do realise and certainly need to realise is that the scientific input is only one element of any big decision that politicians have to make. But I think science education is very important, and it's important that people, all voters, should at least have some feel for science, because more and more of the decisions politicians have to take, whether they're about health or energy or the environment, clearly have a scientific dimension. If public debate is to rise above mere sloganeering, everyone needs to have enough of a feel for science to avoid becoming bamboozled by propaganda and bad statistics. The need for proper debate will become ever more acute in the future as pressures on the environment and pressures resulting from misdirected technology get more diverse and more threatening. In this respect, one of the most frightening outcomes from the era of Trump and his ilk has been a death of facts. In today's post-truth era, when there's little agreement on what defines reliable sources, we may have to take inspiration from Galileo, who, perhaps apocryphally, was reported after being forced to deny that the earth goes round the sun, to have muttered, "And yet it moves." This was a rallying cry, a reminder that in spite of what you may believe, the facts always remain the same. And I would say also that there's another equally important reason for science education, which is that we ought to understand the world around us. We ought to understand human anatomy. We ought to understand the nature of the physical world and maybe even the universe. And so I think it's very important to understand science, to understand the world we're living in, and also, I think, to understand science because it is something which is a great cultural value. And science has the virtue that it's something which spans all nations. You know, protons and proteins are the same whether you're in the West or in China. And so we should focus on those as part of culture as well as being of practical use. And also something which tends to bridge barriers. Indeed, one has found throughout history that the scientists have been able to span national divides more readily than any other segment of society.
Mm-hmm. My sense, given the experience that we just went through with the pandemic, mm-hmm. is that one of the most urgent public education aspects of this is the scientific method and the uncertainty that's associated with how science develops or how our knowledge develops.
Yes, I completely agree that some people think that scientists know all the answers. Obviously, they don't. They're groping still, but they probably are more worth listening to than the average person in the street. But I think one has to emphasize that sometimes the science is pretty clear, whereas sometimes it's still very uncertain. And also, when one is doing science, one has to realize that there are some problems we're trying to solve, which we can expect to solve fairly quickly. And there are some problems which are deeply important for the natural world, which are going to be very difficult. And indeed, some is maybe beyond the human brain completely. We can be helped a bit by AI and all that, but maybe not too much.
Going back to the question of scientists' involvement in policymaking, you know, you know more than anyone, perhaps, that scientists have been telling political leaders for quite some time about the urgency of addressing climate change and a number of other of these issues. Yet there doesn't seem to be, as you pointed out, you know, this political appetite or even, you know, the ability to look far enough ahead to deal with these issues. Mm. At what point is it appropriate for scientists to speak out, to actually be activists and demand that governments take action on things like climate change or other urgent issues?
Well, I think they should speak out. But as I say, I think they have a bigger effect if they get their voice amplified by these charismatic figures. But the main point is it's a big ask if the public is going to be told that this may cost something in the short run, but it's for the benefit of future generations.
So it isn't for the average scientist to be an activist?
Well, I think it's scientists should be concerned citizens. They should be activists, but I think they can do better in just advising. But I think it's important for scientists to realize that they are specialists. And when they move outside their area of specialization, then they are just citizens. So they should be responsible citizens, but they should realize that their expertise is limited to a particular area.
In your public role, your role as a public intellectual, how would you describe your role as a scientist on the public stage?
Well, I should say that I'm not a sort of charismatic influencer, so I don't do that. But I have been involved, obviously, in government committees and things like that. And also having the chance to speak to a lot of the younger generation of students. And I think in doing that sort of thing, one can emphasize things outside one's expertise, even though realizing that, as I said, we don't have special rights to be heard there, simply because everyone ought to be more concerned about these global issues. I mean, everyone in the world ought to surely care about what the world will be like when their grandchildren grow old, that we shouldn't leave a depleted heritage to future generations, when we bear in mind how much we have benefited from the heritage of previous generations. I think we have an obligation to enlighten people. And of course, the other reason I do that is because I think that the ideas of science are fascinating. And quite apart from their practical application, I think it's very sad that people don't realize, the wonders of Darwinian evolution and the fact that we now know that there are billions of planets like the Earth orbiting other stars and all these things. They certainly fascinate a wide public. And as an astronomer, of course, I'm lucky because astronomy is one of these subjects, I guess ecology is another one, which has a sort of fairly positive public image.
Yes.
Say you're a nuclear scientist, people might be a bit ambivalent, but I think the sciences like astronomy, they have a wide amateur following, of course. If I'm on a plane or a train, I don't want to speak to my neighbour, I say I'm a mathematician. Whereas if I'm happy to speak to them, I say I'm an astronomer. And then the first question I'd be asked is, do you think we're alone in the universe? Or are there aliens? And of course, that's a question I can't answer.
Yes.
Although, incidentally, I hope we will get some better ideas about the likelihood of that during this century. That's why the subject is so exciting.
Yeah. As long as you're not mistaken as an astrologer.
Right, yes.
Yes.
Yes. And I think there's a message for education here, because young kids are fascinated by some things. They're fascinated by dinosaurs and by space, both blazingly irrelevant to their everyday lives. But they fascinate young kids. Well, you probably know this, but I don't know if you've got any yourself, but I know some 5-year-olds who know different species of dinosaurs when they can barely read.
It's so true.
But the important thing is to ensure that the teaching that they get is good enough that it doesn't quench that enthusiasm completely. And the worry I have in many countries is that the number of inspiring science teachers is such that most kids don't get exposed to one. And so by the time they are 16 and thinking about their careers and what subjects to specialize in, they may have turned against science. And that'll be very sad.
Well, you mentioned young people, so I am curious what you think of the way the arts, the humanities and social sciences are kind of being sidelined in so many universities with all the focus on STEM, science, technology.
Well, I think that's wrong. And I'm glad it's not happening in my university at Cambridge. But I do think that we need a fairly broad curriculum. I think that we need to cherish the humanities and ensure that everyone can follow them and do the arts, and also ensure that music teaching in schools is good, etc. So I think it will be very sad. And I'm very sad to learn if in Canada the universities are cutting back on these things. The humanities and social sciences should engage us all as human beings. But scientists have an extra reason for supporting their continuing prominence in our universities, for promoting not just science, technology, engineering and maths, but the arts, broadly interpreted as well. We need an acronym STEAM, not just STEM, where the extra A is for the arts. These subjects sensitize and guide the public in assigning how science should be applied. There's an ever-widening gap between what science allows us to do and what it's prudent or ethical actually to do. I emphasize widely held anxieties that genetics and artificial intelligence may run away too fast, and that our imprint on the global environment could be irreversibly damaging. Answers to these dilemmas can't come from within natural science itself, but as part of their education, all students should surely be attuned to these issues.
Taking stock of the different threats that we've been talking about, from AI to climate change, can you speak to how critical for the future of humanity it is, the decisions that politicians will be making in the next few years?
Well, I think that it is crucial because one important point, which I think I make in my book, is that astronomers, of course, are used to thinking about long spans of time. And if you think in that cosmic perspective, we know that the Earth has existed for 45 million centuries. But this is the first of those centuries when one species, the human species, has the power to determine the future of the entire planet. And so we are living in a special century. And of course, the other thing which one learns from astronomy and indeed from other sciences is that we are not the termination. Our sun is less than halfway through its life. It's got 6 billion more years to go. And so we humans shouldn't think of ourselves as the culmination of evolution. We're maybe not even the halfway stage. And so if we screw things up now this century, we could be foreclosing the possibility of developments even more exciting than anything we could conceive. And this is a perspective which I think should be a bit more widely disseminated, because it does make people care more about the long term. And of course, this then raises the question about whether the Earth is a very special place, as well as us being around a special time. Is the Earth the only place where intelligent life has evolved? In which case, it's a cosmic disaster if we screw up. Or is there already life out there in many different places? That's the question that fascinates everyone. You don't need to be a scientist to find that fascinating. And it's a question where scientists are starting to, if not find definite answers, they've got evidence which is going to enable us to firm up the odds a bit.
You write that the stakes have you just said, I mean, the stakes have never really been higher than they are today. And you point out that we came out of the pandemic more or less intact, in large part because of a stable electrical grid and the internet and scientists. But how real is the risk of a major social breakdown?
Well, I mean, I fear it is serious because, well, first of all, we could have had a pandemic with a far higher death rate, because the death rate from COVID-19 was about 1%, wasn't it? But supposing that it had been equally transmissible, but with a death rate like Ebola or something like that, that would have been an utter global catastrophe from which civilization might never recover. And of course, my worst nightmare is an engineered pandemic, which could be far worse than that, artificially released. And the other thing I worry about is that, you know, we haven't talked very much about AI, but people worry about the machines taking over and superintelligence, etc. There's something in that, but I think we've got to make sure that humans stay in the loop. And, you know, if we are recommended for surgery or sent to prison or something, it's not enough to say the machine says that and the machine is reliable. We need to feel that there's a human being in the loop and that we can contest the decision, because these programs could have hidden bugs in them, which only reveal themselves later. And the real danger is if society becomes dependent on these and there's a failure. I mean, if the electric grid in a major fraction of a country fails, then that leads to chaos within a few days at most. And my worry is that if we get too vulnerable to that sort of thing, then it could be irrecoverable if something happens and it's not something which can be easily repaired.
Martin Rees, the title of your book is the beginning of a sentence, "If Science is to Save Us."
Yes.
How would you complete that sentence?
Well, I'd say science has to be a topic which everyone has a feel for, so that they understand what scientists can plausibly tell them and where the scientists are themselves groping. They've got to understand the scope of science and the limits of science and our dependence on science. And they've got to be able to decide which applications they want to support and promote and which should be banned on ethical grounds or on prudential grounds.
Well, it's a very important message, and we're really grateful that you spoke to us about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Martin Rees is Emeritus Professor of Cosmology and Astrophysics at the University of Cambridge and a member of the UK House of Lords. His latest book is If Science is to Save Us. This episode was produced by Chris Wadskow. Technical production, Danielle Duval.
Our web producer is Lisa Ayuso. Senior producer, Nicola Luksic. Greg Kelly is the executive producer of Ideas. And I'm Nala Ayed.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.